Biram Tsuga Press presents The Fire God of Cahokia by Ronald R. Van Stockham, Jr. Illustrations by Stephen P. Eilers. Read for you by Tracy Bond Bird. Copyright 2017 by Reginald R. Van Stockham, Jr. All rights reserved. And now, The Fire God of Cahokia.
God, I cannot do this, said the frightened, dirty human.
The creature's response was seemingly truculent, but fully measured. It was akin to the sound of a surging brook, the melody of which formed words, not the noise of water breaking on bank and boulder.
I am not your god, and you will build it. I will take you to the place now.
No emotion attended this odd communication. But through the control of diaphragm expansion and trumpet-like acceleration in the creature's spiracles, pitch was added for emphasis. The people living in the swampside village had recently become frightened by new sounds squealing out of the forest. That's how it began. This is what had sent Elber fearfully into the dark, seeking the source of this new danger. Elber was the leader of this small clan of families and was the priest of its fire. He maintained control of his people through exercise of the fire myth, God's presence on earth, his warmth, his bounty, his vengeance. But now some terrible new force had appeared in the woods. It must be placated for the people to survive, and it was for their leader to do so. It was not hard for Elbert to find the creature. It was awaiting him. Thus had begun their discussions. The squealing silenced when Elber returned to his people. He had seen the God of Fire, he said, spoken with him. What did he say? That God now claimed this village as his chosen people, people who would build the largest temple ever constructed to God. By this act, the people would prove their love of their God and would receive back tenfold of riches. Or so the creature instructed Elber to state. None of it was true, of course. But the social act of building the mound would attract additional clans to Elber's village. And with more people, the village would have more power. That was attractive to Elber. Titillating, actually. It is what the thought of power does to the young. Yet Elber resisted. The thought of such a huge mound was beyond his imagination. And he was crafty. He was unwilling to risk losing control of that which he already possessed, his people. Perhaps there was something more to gain, he thought. Tools? No, but maybe. Yes, weapons. These peoples were not primitive. The human species was much advanced and evolved in the exploitation of its environment. Their greatest talent was, however, in their imaginations, in their desires. They were capable of accomplishing almost all that they could conjure. They just needed the time to explore their thoughts and experiment. So it would be written by one of their descendants. Whatever one man can imagine, another will someday be able to achieve. Elber began a journey that would result in the great cultural efflorescence at Cahokia, the largest city in native North America. But that name is not what the original inhabitants called it. They left no written records when they mysteriously disappeared. On the instructed evening, long after the western sword of light had fallen to the steady droll of mist and rain, Elber returned to face the creature. He was wet, but his skins repelled the water just as they had done while still clothing his living prey. He was proud of his skins. He had killed many great animals with his spear. In this culture, warriors led. Elber had taken the fire of his predecessor by force, killed him. Elber was young, strong, virile, and willing. He would follow the creature up the hill. There was something to gain here.
I will show your land, the place for the temple, blubbered the creature.
Its usually bubbling cascade of sound was drowned in the bass notes of the rain.
Come.
Elber smiled. The more he learned of the unknown, the less he feared it. He noted that rain seemed to pour from beneath the creature's skins. It was smooth under there, he thought. Hard, not flesh. There must be weak points in its joints.
He wondered now about the creature's head. A furry animal skin cap was pulled tightly over its cranium, but there was movement evident below. What was it? Elber stopped staring as the creature swung its terrifying beak-like face toward him. It looked down and focused its two large prismatic compound eyes on the human. "I will not be afraid," thought Elber, and he forcefully returned his eyes to meet the terrifying gaze. He always remembered that moment as the turning point in his life, the moment when his fear was swept aside as he looked at God. For there was something he recognized in that awful visage, something akin to himself, something deep and constrained. It was humanity. And he knew then that he was created from the same image as that of the creature. Elber could never explain this recognition to another. Words are symbols, stupid registers of passing events. Once said, they are dead. Much like the meager impact of this reading, words can only serve as shimmering reflection of something much more rich and meaningful, the call of the dead for that which is alive, seeking the compassion of those who still possess it. Elber raised his spear in salute. The creature neither spoke nor acknowledged his movement. It simply turned and began to move away, upslope through the forest. Elber pulled in behind the creature to follow along a stream flowing from the hills beyond. Aquatic mesentery feeding the guts of this river, draining life from its lands into the depth of water. The Mayan twins were right. Rivers are the route to Xibalba, the dark world beneath us. But they were climbing up, not down. By the time they reached the summit of those high constricting bluffs, the rain had moved on, pushed south by the cold winds sweeping off the glacial wastelands to the north. Elber tied a leather strap up under the furry collar of his outermost skin. It had been taken from a hairy and huge short-nosed bear. Elber had killed and skinned it alone. It was a sign of his prowess. He wore the fur side turned in. Elber followed the creature to a naked limestone promontory overlooking the wide valley with its sinewy, silvery band meandering down the middle of its bed. There was no moon, but the scorpion was high, with its back blazing bright red like Mars. And there above its tail was one of the wanderers, the brightest of those late-night enigmatic voyagers that move by celestial winds through the sea of star islands. Elber thought that somehow this bright spot, planet Jupiter we know now, tracked him and his approach to the scorpion-like creature that he followed. The creature extended one of its claw-like hands.
"There," it babbled.
Elber could see the outline of an old abandoned course of the river, now full of standing water forming a moonlight crescent lake. His people were camped alongside, their fire strung out along its shore. "Yes, there," pointed Elber, trying to understand the creature.
"No,"
said the creature, and it swung so that its claw pointed downstream to a patch of darkness. The creature snapped its claws open and closed to emphasize its action. Elber quickly stepped back into a defensive crouch and raised his spear. The creature dropped its limb and again turned to stare blankly at the terrified human. Elber gathered strength, lowered his spear, rose, and moved to the cliff edge. He reached out and pointed. "There?" he said, squinting to see what was in the darkness.
"Hole," gurgled the creature. "Build the temple," it suddenly blurted out.
Then the world seemed to collapse around Elber. Screaming, screeching, terrible sounds descended upon him. Blackness came crashing through the stout, gnarly woods bordering the cliff's edge and fell upon them. Elber swung violently around, bringing up his spear to accept the attack. Saber cats and a giant sloth were advancing on them both. But the creature had moved even more quickly. It rose up to a towering height before Elber and, with a sweep of the claw, struck off its cap. What Elber saw paralyzed him, for what he saw was staring back at him. The creature's head was alive with snakes. Not really snakes, but writhing, serpent-like appendages. A single glassy orb seemed to be implanted at the end of each wriggling protuberance, and two of them bore directly down on him.
The creature continued to rise and seemingly expand in size before Elber. Its skin showed itself as only leather trappings, and the creature threw them off as it reached full proportion. Only then did Elber see the third set of limbs, appendages with hands that had been hidden beneath the creature's clothing. The creature now stood fully exposed, firmly planted on two stout legs, terminating in thick-toed foot pads. Pale starlight outlined the smooth, chitinous exoskeleton of the creature as it now faced the horror before them. Be not confused by the time I take to tell of this transformation and what occurred next. In true time, it happened as quickly as you could think and write of it. But another divergence is necessary to adequately describe the danger that had enveloped them. Not for tens of thousands of years have such things been seen in these lands, and the creature would meet them directly and immediately. At the center of it all, and the cause of the crashing chaos, was a gigantic, long-clawed ground sloth. Elber knew of these animals, avoided them on the rare occasions that they were encountered. Sloths were slow, lumbering plant eaters, but they could not be killed, at least not in any way Elber's people had discovered. Spears just seemed to stick in the sloth's fatty flesh, mockingly twitching like twigs as it moved away. But that was also when it was most dangerous. A sloth was capable of lightning-fast movement of its terribly massive arms, and at the terminus of those arms grew the longest, sharpest, hardest claws in nature. None would dare challenge the giant sloth. Until now. A sudden swing from the sloth gutted one of the saber cats that dug its incisors into the sloth's throat. The cat's intestines were caught by the tips of the beast's claws and were drawn out like ribbons as the squealing cat was thrust away through the air. But that relief was of little help to the sloth. It was under siege by many of the vicious cats. Elber feared them. They were killers, death-dealing felines stalking anything foolish enough to be out in darkness. Keeping them at bay was one of the great benefits of fire, and those appointed to maintain the nightly fires had achieved a prestigious post indeed. Fortunately, Elber had not confronted such a cat. That was why he still lived. This sloth had been intentionally attacked. It was a nocturnal, peaceable animal, which the cats had always given way because of its size and claws. But now handfuls of them were leaping onto the beast, only to be torn off by its furiously clawing arms. Some dug their canines into its legs, hoping to topple the sloth into the midst of the pride. Elber had never seen so many saber cats at once, had not known that they gathered in packs. That's when he saw it, the shimmering form in the nearby tree. It blinked on and off, and Elber could not make out a distinct form. But he could discern that the cats were responding to the gesticulations of the shimmering form urging them on in the attack, and he could see that more cats were collecting in the darkness. Again, I take the time to describe this fantastic scene in enough detail to make you aware of its significance. But in reality, it happened just as fast as the creature's immediate turn to face the struggling sloth. As the creature moved forward into battle, it extended its newly exposed middle left limb and pointed with one of its digits to the shimmering form away to its left. Elber could not later explain his movement in response because his action was done without any thought. He simply rose up, reared back with the spear, and lurched forward, launching the missile at the shimmering form. Blink off. Missed. The spear dug deeply into the trunk of the tree behind the apparition, but the shimmering form did not reappear. The creature had entered the battle with formidable weapons. Its upper left claw had snapped open and began a sinister spinning, the sharp edges of the claw facing outward. He swung it down onto the mass of cat flesh he encountered, slicing through muscle and bone, limb and skull. The saber cats soon diverted their attention to this new attacker, providing relief to the embattled sloth. They leapt onto the creature, clamoring to gain purchase. Their teeth, however, could not puncture its smooth chitin armor. When they attacked, an effective tactic was used by the creature to take advantage of the cat's momentum. When a cat launched, one of the creature's middle arms would fold over, grasp the cat with its hand, and pin it, squealing and writhing, against its body. Positioned thus, the creature could dispatch all that jumped within its grasp. There was a purpose for its upper right limb, too. It was also sharp-clawed and snapped open going into battle. Forming a long-penetrating, pike-like blade, it caught and gutted anything within its swing. Relieved of the assault by an overwhelming number of cats, the sloth recovered and was soon wading in among the remaining attackers, sweeping them up like field mice with its giant claws. The sloth then tossed their ripped bodies, howling into the abyss beyond the cliff. They were working together now, the creature and the giant ground sloth. But Elber did not know how. He did not see them communicating. One cat, whether by design or chance, had hurled itself low and to the backside of the creature. One of its fangs sank deep into the fleshy folds of tissue articulation where the middle arm joined the creature's trunk. A hiss of agony escaped the creature as it faltered, catching itself and stepping backward. Furiously, it struck with both clawed arms, but was unable to reach that one awkward position. The cat was aware of the success of its blow and violently dug its fangs into the joint in an attempt to bring the creature down. Elber could explain what happened next because he had consciously determined to do it. He reached inside his leathers to a pouch sewn within. He pulled out a flint blade that had been hafted with strips of deer sinew onto a stub end of an Osage orange tree limb. The knife was not as sharp as that with an obsidian edge, but it would do. With a scream well known to signal his attack, he leapt forward onto the cat's back, jabbing and piercing until it hung limp and dead, held only by a single long fang in the creature's joint. Grabbing the cat's head and obtaining purchase through its eye sockets, Elber twisted the head until the tooth broke off, dropping the dead cat to the ground. The creature stepped forward again, fully into the fray. But there was little left to do now. The few cats that remained and fought seemed disoriented in the absence of the shimmering form. They were soon killed or escaped into the woods. After all of the screaming, crashing, and squealing, it suddenly became quiet, the cliff entirely silent. The kind of silence where the only thing you hear is the blood pulsating in your ear canal. Eerie silence. Like that left by the voices of Cahokia, now gone. The giant sloth was wounded, but not mortally. It reached down to patches of lichen on the exposed limestone ledge and pressed them into its wounds to slow the bleeding. Then, looking back carefully at the creature, the sloth turned slowly and lumbered back into the forest. Elber approached the creature, motioning to its limp left middle arm. Looking into its eyes, he described the wound by sign, the tooth penetration, and his determination to remove it. The creature said nothing, but carefully turned and extended out his arm more fully, exposing the buried fang. Elber had to dig three of his fingers into the wound to fully grasp it. The creature did not respond with either sound or movement. Elber slowly and steadily withdrew the tooth, flesh closing in around the penetration as it was removed. As it was pulled out, a whitish, sticky fluid began to seep and ooze out of the wound. Bleeding for this creature, thought Elber, as he reached down for some of that same lichen used by the sloth. He patted it down into the creature's wound until the bleeding stopped. The creature turned to stare again at Elber, its cranial-stalked eyelets taking up visual positions so as to warn it of a renewed attack from any direction. With its right middle hand, the creature again pointed to the dark patch in the land below. "Dig down," he gurgled. "Build the temple." Then, saying no more, the creature dropped down and, using his middle arms as additional legs, loped off after the way of the sloth. And so Elber did. Dig down, that is. But he did not build the temple. That would be left to those who came after him. The area pointed out by the creature was a flat ridge of land rising slightly between two sloughs, former channels of the great river. And its deep soil was underlain by stone, a subterranean ridge of limestone extending out from the bluffs behind. It was an intact base, but heavily solutionalized by the water surrounding and draining through it. In fact, it contained an extensive cave system, now mostly flooded, but of which the upper ridge was then dry. That was where he was told to dig, in a depression on the top of the low ridge, a nascent sinkhole. Elber dug and broke through into the cave system below. He built up a barrier wall of dirt surrounding the opening and cut steps leading down into it. He spent much time down those steps. In the years to come, Elber laid down his spear, never killing again. He studied his people, experimented with governance, seeking productivity, efficiency, and compassion. He remembered that feeling with the creature on the cliff. It was a feeling of meaning, inclusion, and love, greater than that of the flesh. He thought upon it, expanded it into his actions, and infused it into his people. He discovered that the greatest expression of this humanity was in forgiveness. That was a surprising development in his governing philosophy, and he successfully built upon it. Elber's temperate wisdom soon spread among other peoples living along the river. Over time, more wanderers joined his clan, hunted, and gardened in the river bottoms, and entered into a meaningful dialogue. Elber died at an extraordinary age for that time, having brought much advancement in thought and understanding, tools, and technology to his people. They, in turn, loved him, respected and feared him. Many came to jealousy over his continued control of fire. Wasn't it right to pass on that knowledge and honor to a younger one? Elber never did. When they found him dead in his hut within the earthen walls around the pit, they found his knife of flint hafted onto an Osage orange limb for a handle. It had been much used and worn down. It lay alongside a mysterious, heavy, globular rock. The rock was an iron-rich meteorite, and the people, through fearful experimentation, would discover that striking it with the flint knife ignited specks of iron sufficient to capture fire. Even in his death, Elber had given to his people. They were soon striking flint against all types of rocks, finding many iron-rich chunks that had been carved out by the gouging glaciers and washed down from the north in icy waters. They were in awe of the man. He had given them fire. He surely must have been a god. As he had wished, they laid Elber's lifeless body on the steps down. None had ever ventured within the cave entrance, much less the lower passages, and covered him with dirt. Then they slowly filled in the hole with the wall of dirt surrounding it. The site became a holy place where it was believed one could commune with the dead through the intercession of the fire god. Stories of his deeds turned into legends, and legends then into myths. He became one of the gods they placed in the heavens. You can see him now in late summer, up there next to the scorpion, pouring fire on its tail. The embers still glow. You can see them in the faint nebulas from Elber's fire, hovering over the scorpion's tail. Look with binoculars and you will see them easily. But even without the aid of binoculars, you can see them on a dark night by averting your eyes slightly as you look. Have you ever looked? You might believe more of this story if you do. Or perhaps just wonder at its meaning, the connectedness of it all. We call two of those nebulas the Butterfly Cluster, Messier Object 6, and Ptolemy's Cluster, Messier Object 7. When the planet Jupiter again visits that region of the heavens, and it will in your lifetime, think of Elber and his journey of compassion. Be patient. The wanderer will come again. It became a tradition of the river peoples to come with a basket of earth to sprinkle over the site of Elber's burial. The burial site slowly rose up to become one of the earliest and most majestic mortuary mounds of the Adena people. It would later rise further through the Hopewell period, spurring on the magnificent Mississippian mounds of the Cahokia peoples. And the new weapons that Elber hoped to wheedle from the creature? They also came later. A spear thrower with dart and shaft. A weapon capable of repetitive firing. And one that could be made stealthy, too. Such a weapon was more efficient for the smaller game that remained when the ice receded and the big animals, including the saber cats and giant ground sloths, disappeared. A myth was created that Elber had received knowledge of the weapon from the creature. Oh yes, they knew the creature had existed, not as God, but God's messenger. Messages of knowledge given only to Elber. The new weapon was named after that creature, although no one knew how they had obtained the name. The creature was called Exordal. And thus, so very much later when Bernal Diaz encountered the weapon in the Spanish conquest of Mexico, he recorded its name as Atlatl, the Aztec adaptation of its name in their native Nahuatl language. It was the only weapon Hernán Cortés feared. If you had been able to open Elber's grave and enter down his steps to the cave below, what would you have found? Discoveries to awe the mind? You would not recognize them as such. Call them mementos of Elber's travels. Yes, he traveled widely through that underground portal. You might see a woodland period water vessel, an archaic period three-quarter grooved axe head, or even a small Palestinian oil lamp from Roman times lying on limestone shelves in the passage. But you would not have found the obsidian ball. For you to see that, you would need scuba gear and courage. You would have to climb down to a pool at the lowest level of the cavern, slide on your breathing apparatus, and drop into the cold darkness of the water below. You would need spare tanks of oxygen and a stout line to mark your passage back to the safety of your world. It is a perilous path you take when leaving home, whether that be a house or a planet. But if you did all these things and found the correct path through the honeycomb of submerged passages, you would rise up until you broke the surface of another pool of water, a sump at the end of a huge, dry, paleo-trunk cave passage. Through that passage flowed a small river that fell into the sump. Here you would have to take out waterproof flares, strike them, and toss them about to shed light into that gigantic cavern. Then, removing your gear and thrusting it onto the bank, you would pull yourself onto the ledge. Rising, you might miss the placement of small rocks, a trail, but you would eventually find the room walled in by boulders, and therein, covered by the dusty sheets of time, a bed, chests, bookshelves, and a desk, and on that desk, an obsidian ball. Just a large chunk of glass, you would think, but that chunk of glass will feel warm when you touch it, and it will grow hotter as long as you do, drawing energy from your being. It's the water and cold air, you will say, but it is not, and you will soon enough know it. You have entered the realm of Elber, the fire god of Cahokia. So go to Cahokia. Stand on the great monk's mound. It was named such for the order of Cistercians who built a monastery there. You know, Trappist monks. The same as those in the Kentucky Abbey of Gethsemane, the one wherein a much greater writer than this author lived out his life. He, too, was a seeker of love and wisdom like Elber, and Kentucky is well known for its caves. So go to Cahokia. Stand on the great monk's mound. Look up at night for Elber's embers, the scorpion, and the wandering planet. Descend the mound steps, and in your mind, travel underground into Elber's realm. Think of knowledge, love, inclusion, and forgiveness. And then perhaps you will overlook the poor use of rhetorical devices in this story. For there is value here, and that described is in the greater part true. This author would be well pleased to be so remembered. Ronald R. Van Stuckem, Jr. is a lawyer, teacher, biologist, writer, guitarist, and recently an actor living on his family's old farm in Shelbyville, Kentucky. He has a B.S. in biology from Santa Clara University and an M.S. and Ph.D. in biology from the University of Louisville. He also has his Juris Doctorate in law from the University of Louisville and practices law from offices in Shelbyville, Kentucky. He concentrates his legal practice in environmental law and his biologic research in historical phytogeography. Dr. Van Stuckem has published numerous articles in the area of law, science, and creative writing. He has published 7 short stories and 3 novels of fiction science and magic realism. They are entitled Markman's Home, Cosmos, the Stellar Stalker, and Markman's Cave.